This is the Music Halls of Fame podcast. This week, we honor the year 2004, along with a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame class of 2004. We look at the case for putting the group Garbage into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Plus, our spotlight Hall of Fame is the Grammy Hall of Fame and Museum in Los Angeles, California. Before we get going with the podcast, like everyone tells you, please like, subscribe, and hit the notification bell so you'll know when these podcast episodes drop, which is usually every Thursday. Now, on to this week's episode. The year was 2004. In music, the only things people could talk about were Britney Spears marrying and divorcing her childhood friend Jason Allen Alexander, all in 3 days, mind you, and then later in the year, marrying dancer Kevin Federline. Of course, there was also Ashley Simpson lip-syncing her performance on Saturday Night Live and the Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction event with Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson on February 1st. Other events of 2004 included opera star Luciano Pavarotti performing in his final opera, the Lollapalooza Festival being canceled because of unsold tickets, Elton John starting his Las Vegas residency at Caesar's Palace, the massive Rock in Rio concert festival taking place, Paul Rogers joining Queen for a little while, The Killers and Velvet Revolver debuting, as did the Jazz at Lincoln Center performing venue. And, of course, there was the Dave Matthews Band tour bus dumping their raw sewage into the Chicago River, hitting a tour boat that was in the absolute worst place at the absolute worst time. At that point, you have to figure, what did you do in your life to deserve that? Ugh. Anyway, the biggest selling album of that year was Usher's Confessions. Other big albums that year were Kenny Chesney's When the Sun Goes Down, Green Day's American Idiot, Norah Jones's Feels Like Home, Avril Lavigne's Under My Skin, U2's How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb, Gwen Stefani's Love Angel Music Baby, Anastasia's self-titled album, Maroon 5's Songs About Jane, Evanescence's Fallen, Ashley Simpson's autobiography, Eminem's Encore, the Jay-Z and Linkin Park collaboration Collision Course, and Tim McGraw's Live Like You Were Dying, along with some best-selling greatest hits albums from Britney Spears, Shania Twain, Guns N' Roses, and Robbie Williams. The biggest single of the year was Usher's Yeah. Other big singles of the year included Ciara's Goodies, Snoop Dogg's Drop It Like It's Hot, Avril Lavigne's My Happy Ending, Alicia Keys' If I Ain't Got You, along with her other hit, My Boo, with Usher, Jaquan's Tipsy, Mario's I Don't Wanna Know, Fat Joe and Terror Squad's Lean Back, Ashley Simpson's Pieces of Me, and Nina Sky's Move Your Body. In country music, the biggest singles included Toby Keith's American Soldier, Tim McGraw's Live Like You Were Dying, and also Back When, Keith Urban's Days Go By, Terry Clark's Girls Lie Too, George Strait's I Hate Everything, Montgomery Gentry's If You Ever Stop Loving Me, Phil Vassar's In a Real Love, Rascal Flatts' Mayberry, Lone Star's Mr. Mom, Gary Allen's Nothing On But the Radio, Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman, and Alan Jackson's Remember When. The biggest albums were released by Keith Urban, Rascal Flatts, Gretchen Wilson, Big and Rich, Jimmy Buffett, Tim McGraw, Alan Jackson, Kenny Chesney, along with Greatest Hits albums by George Strait and Shania Twain. In hip-hop, Kanye's debut album, The College Dropout, dropped that year. Some of the biggest albums were released by Eminem, D12, Lloyd Banks, Nelly, Young Buck, The Beastie Boys, Ludacris, and a Tupac posthumous release called Loyal to the Game. The biggest selling hip-hop album of 2004 actually dropped in 2003. It was Outkast's Speakerbox The Love Below, especially after they won the 2003 Grammy Award for Album of the Year. Some of the biggest singles included Drop It Like It's Hot by Snoop Dogg and Pharrell Williams, Outkast's The Way You Move, Jay-Z's Dirt Off Your Shoulder and 99 Problems, Twista and Kanye's Slow Jams, Twista's Overnight Celebrity, Kanye's All Falls Down, along with his song Jesus Walks, and also Through the Fire. You remember when you could just love Kanye and not have to deal with all the baggage that came along with Kanye? Man, those were good days. Good days. Anywho, other hip-hop hits included Nelly and Tim McGraw's Over and Over, Lloyd Banks's On Fire, Fabulous's Breathe, and Lil Wayne's Go DJ. In dance music, DJ and presenter Annie Mack started her legendary career at BBC One Radio in England. The club play charts were, as usual, dominated by pop and R&B artists. This time around, those crossover artists included Britney Spears, Duran Duran, Annie Lennox, Elton John, Dido, Madonna, Simply Red, Janet Jackson, Beyoncé, and George Michael. Quote-unquote legit dance artists who also made the top of the dance charts included Goldfrapp, the legendary Frankie Knuckles, Curtis Mantronic, Christine W., Junior Jack, Robbie Rivera, The Shapeshifters, Dirty Vegas, along with Eric Prydz's version of Steve Winwood's hit song Valerie, which was called Call On Me. The top DJs on DJ Mag's Top 100 DJs list were Tiesto, Paul Van Dyke, Armin Van Buuren, Sasha, Ferry Corsten, Hernan Cataño, and Christopher Lawrence. In Latin music, Daddy Yankee released the best-selling Latin album of the decade, Barrio Fino. The album helped reggaeton crash headlong into the mainstream at that point. The most critically acclaimed Latin artist of the year, though, was Alejandro Sanz. Other big Latin artists were Los Temerarios, Paulina Rubio, Juanes, Grupo Climax, Luis Miguel, Marc Anthony, Los Tigres del Norte, Adán Sánchez, and Intocable. Broadway shows or revivals of Broadway shows that opened included Assassins, Bombay Dreams, Fiddler on the Roof, The Woman in White, and People Are Wrong. Musical movies for the year included Ray, Beyond the Sea, The Lovely, The Phantom of the Opera, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, along with animated movies Pixel Perfect and Home on the Range. Bands that formed in 2004 included Body Rockers, Bring Me the Horizon, Ryan Adams and the Cardinals, Cascada, Camel Fat, Ali and AJ, Digitalism, Fort Minor, Nero, Pompeii, Panic at the Disco, and Paramore. Brian McFadden left the group Westlife and Clint Lowry left the group Seven Dust. Bands that either broke up before, of course, their inevitable reunions or announced their hiatus included All About Eve, The Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, No Doubt, Atomic Kitten, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Orbital, Concrete Blonde, Jan and Dean, Jane's Addiction, Sixpence None the Richer, Matchbox 20, Creed, King Crimson, and Yes. Bands that got back together for a little while in 2004 included Destiny's Child, New York Dolls, Megadeth, and Restless Heart. Artists who were born in 2004 included Grace Vanderwaal and Mackenzie Ziegler. Dimebag Daryl of Pantera was shot 3 times in the head and killed while performing on stage by a deranged fan who then went and killed 3 other people before finally being taken down by police. Other artists who passed away in 2004 included the legendary Mr. Ray Charles, the King of Punk Funk himself, Mr. Rick James, Johnny Ramone of the Ramones, singer Laura Branigan, singer Sasha Distel, Izora Armstead of the Weather Girls, Jimmy Hassel of First Edition, Cornelius Bumpus of the Doobie Brothers, entertainer Ann Miller, Peggy DeCastro of the DeCastro Sisters, John McHugh of Susie and the Banshees, Jan Barry of Jan and Dean, Nikki Sullivan of Buddy Holly and the Crickets, Felix Haug of Double, Arthur Kane of the New York Dolls, Michael Connor of Pure Prairie League, Bruce Palmer of Buffalo Springfield, Alex Soria of the Nils, rappers Old Dirty Bastard, Billboard and Mac Dre, bandleader Artie Shaw, DJ John Peel, jazz drummer Elvin Jones, record producer Corthon, and composers Jerry Goldsmith and Elmer Bernstein. In awards for the music of 2004, at the Grammy Awards, it was the year of Ray Charles, who had put out an album the same year that he passed away, and who won Record and Album of the Year, while John Mayer won Song of the Year and Best New Artist went to Maroon 5 over Josh Stone and Kanye, go figure. Surprisingly, he did not storm the stage at that point. At the American Music Awards, Usher and Sheryl Crow were the big winners. At the Billboard Music Awards, Usher won Artist of the Year. At the MTV Video Music Awards, OutKast won Video of the Year for Hey Ya. Usher won Male Entertainer of the Year, and Ciara won Female Entertainer of the Year at the Soul Train Music Awards. U2, Alicia Keys, Shania Twain, Tim McGraw, Brooks and Dunn, and Usher with Ludacris and Lil Jon won the music categories at the People's Choice Awards. At the Eurovision Singing Contest that was held that year in Istanbul, Turkey, it was the country of Ukraine who won for the song Wild Dances. Kenny Chesney won Entertainer of the Year at the Country Music Association Awards, and he also won Entertainer of the Year at the Academy of Country Music Awards. Keane won Best British Album for Hopes and Fears, and Will Young won Best Song for Your Game at the Brit Awards. Billy Talent won Best Album for his self-titled album, while KOS won Best Song for Crab Bucket, and Avril Lavigne won Artist of the Year at the Juno Awards. Jet won Album of the Year for Get Born, and they also won Single of the Year for Are You Gonna Be My Girl at the ARIA Music Awards. At the Tony Awards, Avenue Q won Best Musical, and Assassins won Best Revival of a Musical. The Pulitzer Prize for Music went to Paul Moravec for Tempest Fantasy. Musically, at the Academy Awards, Finding Neverland won Best Score, while a song by Jorge Drexler from The Motorcycle Diaries won Best Song. Also, Jamie Foxx won Best Actor for his portrayal of Ray Charles in the movie Ray. Franz Ferdinand won the Mercury Music Prize for their self-titled album that year. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony was held on March 15th at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. Rolling Stone magazine editor Jan Wenner went into the Non-Performer Lifetime Achievement Award category. In 2023, he would be bounced off of the Hall of Fame's board after he made sexist comments about female rock and roll musicians in an interview. The ceremony itself is perhaps best remembered for Prince making sure that guitar did not weep gently when he played a blistering guitar solo on the song While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which was played in honor of George Harrison that year, who was inducted into the Performers category, along with Jackson Browne, The Dells, Traffic, ZZ Top, Bob Seger, and this next artist who played that blistering guitar solo. Prince Rogers Nelson was born on June 7, 1958, and was the product of musical parents. Prince's nickname was Skipper throughout childhood because he hated the name Prince. Prince also suffered from epilepsy when he was younger and often had seizures. The disease did not stop Prince from being involved in sports, including playing basketball. He also studied ballet, which definitely helped him with his dancing skills in his videos and on stage. Prince's parents divorced when he was 10, and the rest of his childhood was spent bouncing around back and forth between parents and his new step-parents, much like children of divorce do these days. Prince also found himself gravitating towards music, having written his first song when he was 7 years old. He was rumored to have learned to play at least 10 instruments pretty well by the time he hit his 20s. By the time he was 19, Prince was signed to a managerial contract, and based on the strength of his demo tape, Prince signed with Warner Brothers Records and released his first album, For You, on April 7, 1978, just 2 months shy of his 20th birthday. A little over a year later, Prince released his self-titled second album, which had the hit I Want to Be Your Lover and also Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad. In 1980, Prince released the album Dirty Mind, which got him into a little bit of trouble with songs like Oh, Head. It also got him an opening act spot on Rick James's tour. 1981's album Controversy spawned the hit of the same name, and around this time, Prince started forming side projects like The Time. Prince's double album, 1999, was released in 1982 and had the top 10 hits in 1999, Little Red Corvette and Delirious. Little Red Corvette was helped by being one of only two songs from black artists that MTV was playing in heavy rotation when the music video came out, the other video being Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. Still, 5 albums in 5 years was only the beginning. Prince was about to become a superstar only 2 years later. After his 1999 album, Prince decided that he wanted to make a movie that was very loosely based on his life. He called the movie Purple Rain. This album was the second album to also credit his band The Revolution, as they did actually help write some of those songs this time around. Certain songs have a bit of a history. Let's Go Crazy is probably the best crafted song about moral ethics ever to be made. The line towards the end about how pills, thrills, and daffodils will kill is now, of course, ironic considering how Prince passed away. The famous drum machine intro after the organs in the beginning is actually Prince's go-to drum machine, the Lin LM1. Take Me With You was supposed to be for his side project Apollonia 6, but instead found its way onto the soundtrack. Contrary to popular belief, the female voice on the song is not Apollonia or Lisa and Wendy from the band. It's singer Jill Jones. Computer Blue was originally a 14-minute song, but that one got cut back. I'm sure the original version will turn up on a special edition of the soundtrack if it hasn't already. Prince played all of the instruments on the songs The Beautiful Ones and Darling Nikki, along with When Doves Cry. For Doves, he was trying to go with a different sound, so he pulled the bass line out of the song. I Would Die For You, Baby I'm a Star, and Purple Rain were all recorded a year earlier at a benefit concert for the Minnesota Dance Theater on August 3, 1983 at the now-famous First Avenue Club that was in the movie. Prince debuted those three songs as well as his new guitarist into the band, Wendy Melvoin. The title track of the album has its own history. According to the Revolution's keyboardist, Dr. Fink, Prince wanted to write a song that sounded almost like it could have come from Bob Seger. The band Journey, however, tells a different story. According to them, Prince called them up one day and mentioned that he had written a song that sounded a lot like their hit song, Faithfully. He wanted their blessing so that, of course, they wouldn't sue him. Not only did they give him their blessing once they heard the song, but they thanked him for asking them, since a lot of bands had ripped off their sound without even asking them first. And if you actually listen to both songs, Purple Rain and Faithfully, back to back, you can really hear the similarity, so good on Prince for asking. Purple Rain, the album, came out on June 25th, 1984 and spent 32 weeks on the Billboard Albums Chart's top 10, taking the number one spot for 24 straight weeks. Purple Rain made rumpled pirate shirts a fashion trend, along with being the basis for a famous Seinfeld episode. It also gave Prince a lot of awards, including Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe, and also an Academy Award for Best Music Score. It's also considered a classic album and one of the greatest albums ever made. In 1986, after Purple Rain, Prince started work with his group The Revolution on a couple new projects. The group was coming off a run where they had put out 3 albums in 3 years. Purple Rain in 1984, Around the World in a Day in 1985, and Parade in 1986. Parade, by the way, was his soundtrack to his movie Under the Cherry Moon. The group were working on a couple of new things. The first was going to be an album called Dream Factory. The second was going to be just Prince himself doing an alter ego named Camille, which was actually his singing sped up and pitched higher. Something happened along the way of doing these albums, though, and Prince broke up The Revolution and got himself a new band. He continued work on his new album, still using a lot of the songs that he and The Revolution had worked up. For some of the songs, he reworked the parts so that someone else could sing them. For a few, like the song Housequake, he kept the idea of using his alter ego voice. He had so many songs that he actually wanted to put out a triple album called Crystal Ball. His record label, Warner Brothers, though, wasn't having that. So everybody compromised and decided on putting out a double album instead. The album title was also changed from Crystal Ball to Sign of the Times. Sign of the Times, the album, was released on March 30th, 1987 in England and March 31st in America. It spawned a concert film along with 3 big hits, Sign of the Times, You Got the Look with Sheena Easton doing vocals on that as well, and I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man. The album was a top 20 hit in 14 different countries, including America, where it hit number 6. It was the 47th biggest selling album of 1987, even though it wasn't a huge seller by superstar standards. It sold just over 1 million copies, but not much more, probably because it was a double album and thus priced much higher than your standard LP record. A lot of critics actually consider it Prince's best work, although I'm still kind of impartial to Purple Rain myself. After the success of Sign of the Times, Prince created new backup groups like the New Power Generation, another movie called Graffiti Bridge, a couple more albums that did pretty well, like Love Sexy, the soundtrack to Graffiti Bridge, along with the soundtrack to Tim Burton's 1989 movie Batman. In the mid-1990s, Prince had very public fights with his record company, with him first going by his famous symbol as his name, and then left his record label, Warner Brothers, altogether and started his own record label. Eventually, he went back to Warner Brothers, but it took a while, and also he kept his own record label and just did a distribution deal. The 20th century was when Prince was a hit-making machine. And while he still put out albums, they weren't anywhere as popular as his albums pre-2000, at least in the 21st century. However, as the 21st century began, Prince became one of the most respected musicians, along with revered status in the industry as a bona fide legend. His 2007 halftime show at the Super Bowl, complete with rain actually coming down when he played the song Purple Rain, is considered by many to be the greatest halftime show of all time. During his surprise appearance at the 2015 Grammy Awards to present the Best Album Grammy, he was treated to an extra long standing ovation and cheers. He also had that blistering guitar solo that had gone down in history as one of the greatest live guitar solos ever now. One last thing that you may not have realized about Prince when he was alive was that even though he was a fashion icon, that cane that he stylishly walked around with wasn't there for the look. Prince injured his hip from all that jumping around that he used to do on stage. He had surgery to repair his hip and had started taking painkillers to deal with the pain. As with a lot of people, he ended up addicted to the pills and put his health in jeopardy. and on April 15, 2016, Prince was taken to a hospital in Illinois while on a private flight back home when he became unconscious. Once released, he went home to his mansion, Paisley Park Studios. He spent the next few days going around town, seeing a jazz performance, among other things. On April 22, 2016, Prince was supposed to see Dr. Howard Kornfeld, who specialized in painkiller addictions, in order to have a physical exam. On the morning of April 21, 2016, Dr. Kornfeld's son came by Paisley Park in order to give Prince the drug buprenorphine, which aids in opioid addiction withdrawal symptoms. By the time the doctor's son reached the house in the morning, Prince was found unresponsive in his elevator at Paisley Park. It was the doctor's son who made the frantic phone call to emergency authorities at 9:43 a.m., and even though the ambulance got there in less than 10 minutes, they couldn't bring him back because Prince had actually been dead in the elevator for at least 6 hours. Prince was pronounced dead at 10:07 a.m. Minnesota time. The official cause of death was an overdose of the painkiller fentanyl, which he was taking to deal with the hip pain. During an investigation into his death, authorities discovered that the fentanyl tablets were disguised as a generic form of the drug hydrocodone. Even though no criminal charges were ever brought concerning the illegal drugs, Prince's death, along with Tom Petty's death from painkillers in 2017, would help to put a very public face on the dangers of painkiller addiction, especially concerning fentanyl and opioids. Prince's ashes are on display in an urn in the atrium of Paisley Park, which is now a museum, along with being a fully functioning recording studio still. In his lifetime, Prince released 42 studio albums. Of those, 15 hit the top 10, with 4 of those hitting number 1. Prince also released 106 singles. Of those, 19 hit the top 10, with 5 of those hitting number 1. Prince was nominated for 32 Grammy Awards, winning 7 of them, 12 MTV Video Music Awards, winning 4 of those, 2 Golden Globes, winning 1 of those, and 1 Academy Award, winning it for Purple Rain. In total, Prince was nominated for 163 awards with 32 wins. He ranks 27th on Rolling Stone magazine's list of greatest artists of all time. He sold over 150 million albums. He's had albums put into the Library of Congress National Recording Registry, and he's been inducted into at least 6 different halls of fame. Presented for induction by Outkast and Alicia Keys, Prince Rogers Nelson, better known as Prince, or Skipper to his childhood friends at least, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004, and we put Purple Rain, Sign of the Times, and his greatest hits onto this week's podcast playlist, the link to which is in the show notes. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you that there is now a Music History in Depth podcast where we go more in depth on a few of the events that happened in music history for that particular week. The Music History in Depth podcast drops every Tuesday on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast from, as does our Music History Today podcast, which goes over the daily events in music history. The Music History Today podcast drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. This week, we look at the case for putting the group Garbage into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Now, people think that the group are actually from the United Kingdom because of their Force of Nature lead singer Shirley Manson, who is from the UK. The group is not, though. The rest of the guys are actually studio musicians from America, and they were founded in Wisconsin. So, with all that said, let's get those stats. To the tail of the tape we go. The group Garbage made 7 studio albums, 3 compilation albums, and 1 EP. Of the studio albums, all of them went top 20, except for 2021's No Gods, No Master, which hit number 33. Their first 2 albums, Garbage and Version 2.0, were their biggest albums, selling over 4 million copies worldwide each. They've sold 17 million albums worldwide in total. They've also released 37 singles. Of those, 6 hit the pop charts. However, their biggest strength was on the alternative rock chart, where they had 13 songs chart with 5 hitting the top 10 and number 1 Crush from the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack hitting number 1 itself. The group were nominated for 7 Grammy Awards, winning none so far anyway. One of those Grammy nominations was in 1999 for Album of the Year for their album Version 2.0. They lost that award to Lauryn Hill's The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, which honestly, yeah, I would have gone with Lauryn Hill myself. Garbage have also been nominated for 2 Brit Awards, winning neither of those. They were nominated for 18 MTV Video Music Awards, both in America and in Europe, winning 2 of those. And the group are still a popular concert draw, and when they put out new albums, which they do, they still sell. Although, okay, maybe not as much as their 1990s heyday. So, are the group Garbage actually worthy of being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Well, they did create a more industrial version of pop alternative than was around in the mid-90s, so from that standpoint, they're trendsetters. Other than that, though, my thought is that they're kind of one of those hall mid-level groups, we'll say. In other words, they're not really obvious for a hall pickup, and they won't get the nod in a few years because of that. But as time goes on and those 90s kids become hall voters themselves and then start throwing in every 90s group that they can think of, I have a distinct feeling that Garbage is going to make that final cut. However, there's a long list of artists who will probably get in before they will. To remind you of how great this band really is, especially in their 90s heyday, we put their greatest hits album, Absolute Garbage, onto this week's podcast playlist for you to check out. And that link, like I said earlier, is in the show notes. This week's Spotlight Music Hall of Fame is the Grammy Museum and Hall of Fame in Los Angeles, California. There's actually 3 Grammy Museums now, with one also in Newark, New Jersey, and the other in Cleveland, Mississippi, to go with the one in LA, which is the main one. The Recording Academy runs the museums, but has been inducting members into its Hall of Fame since 1974. The main Grammy Museum itself, with its Hall of Fame wing, opened in 2008 at LA Live, which is the downtown LA complex that has the former Staples Center, which is now called the Crypto.com Arena, because, yeah, that rolls off your tongue a whole lot easier. Anywho, the museum has 4 floors, including a theater called the Clive Davis Theater, after the famed record executive and music guru, and some of the past exhibits there have paid tribute to John Lennon, Roy Orbison, Shakira, and the world of hip-hop. Plus, they have ticketed evening discussions with artists such as Debbie Gibson, Madison Beer, and Lil Nas X. Ticket prices are $18 for adults, $15 for seniors and military members with ID, and $12 for college students with ID and kids 5 through 17. Children 4 and under and museum members are, of course, free. Its normal hours of operation are Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and closed on Tuesdays. GrammyMuseum.org is its website, and we will put that website in the show notes for you. Jimi Hendrix was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. It was there as a teenager where he learned to play the guitar. When he got out of school, he enlisted in the United States Army, where he joined the paratroopers 101st Airborne Division. Once he was honorably discharged, he moved to the South and started playing gigs, first with the Isley Brothers Band and then backing up Little Richard for a couple of years. Jimmy moved to England in 1966, where he soon drew the attention of Chas Chandler of the Animals, who ended up becoming Jimmy's manager. It was actually socialite and Keith Richards' girlfriend, Linda Keith, who introduced the two men. Funny thing about that was that the Rolling Stones manager was the first one to get the opportunity to be able to manage Jimmy, but he turned Jimmy down, feeling that Jimmy had zero potential. Yeah, zero potential to the greatest guitarist to ever play the instrument. Let that be a lesson to you budding entertainment people out there, that just because you get rejected for an audition or a record contract, it doesn't mean those people were right about you. Keep that in mind. Then it was time to put the band the Jimi Hendrix Experience together. While spectating at a new Animals audition, Jimmy met Noel Redding. Redding played electric guitar at the time, but that slot was obviously kind of taken. Jimmy was impressed with the way Redding knew his way around playing the blues, plus Jimmy liked Noel's fashion sense and wardrobe. So he had Chas ask Noel if he would switch to bass guitar and join the band. Noel said sure. Mitch Mitchell, the drummer, came through a recommendation to Chas. The group started playing together in London, where they picked up a celebrity following. Soon, they had guys like the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Pete Townsend, and others at their gigs to watch them perform. And all this was before they had even put out an album. The Experience put out their first singles, Hey Joe, Stone Free, Purple Haze, and The Wind Cries Mary, before they started recording their first album. The Jimi Hendrix Experience made three albums together. All three of them made Rolling Stone's Top 100 Albums of All Time list. This next album is the lowest on their list of Hendrix material, at number 83. Axis Bold as Love is the middle album of the three Experience albums. It came hot on the heels of their debut album, Are You Experienced? It was also their second album recorded in 1967, since their contract said that they had to do two albums in 1967. Thankfully, the album didn't get released until 1968 because the sales of Are You Experienced were still doing pretty well at that point. With Chas Chandler at the producing helm and Eddie Kramer doing the engineering, the Experience started working on Axis Bold as Love in early May, right after the Are You Experienced sessions were done in April. They did some experimenting with this album, including letting Noel do some of the lead vocals and also using the recorder. The recorder was that first instrument you probably were made to play in grade school before you were allowed to play a regular instrument. The group even played around with a harpsichord that was stored at the recording studio. In June of that year, they stopped recording long enough to travel around Europe playing gigs, and then they went to California to play what turned out to be one of their most important gigs. In April of 1967, Mamas and the Papas member John Phillips had an idea to put on a music festival. He had seen how the Monterey Jazz Festival and the Big Sur Folk Festival were run and respected, and he wanted that for rock music. He got together with record producer Lou Adler and a couple other guys and decided to hold a three-day festival at the Monterey County Fairgrounds in California. The festival was put together in about 7 weeks and was different for a few different reasons. First, most of the acts played for free as the ticket box office was going to charity. The only exceptions to that were Country Joe and the Fish and Ravi Shankar. Second, everyone on the staff was trained and security was plentiful. The staff were even trained on how to take care of concert goers who had taken way too many drugs or were on bad LSD trips. There were also some historical reasons why this festival is still talked about to this very day. One is that it is considered the first event in the Summer of Love that your parents and grandparents like to glowingly talk to you about as the good old days. Technically, the first rock festival happened a week before that, but that festival didn't have earth-shattering, history-making performances like Monterey did, so Monterey gets the nod as the beginning of the Summer of Love. The big reason why people still talk about this festival to this day is because of who became famous right after it and because of it. The festival introduced America to Janis Joplin when she performed with Big Brother and the Holding Company. It also turned Otis Redding into a huge star. It let people get to know Ravi Shankar, and The Who made their mark in America at that festival. The big act, though, which is synonymous with the festival, of course, is Jimi Hendrix. Hendrix made his American debut there after taking England by storm. His performance is legendary, from spinning his guitar around to playing the guitar with his teeth to lighting his guitar on fire and praying to it, something that he had actually done in concert before, but was made memorable after this particular performance of that act. Life was never the same for Jimmy after that, and of course now when you hear the phrase Jimmy plays Monterey, you know exactly what they're talking about. So after the Monterey gig, they played a few shows at the Fillmore in San Francisco, and while on the West Coast, they also did a few recording sessions for Axis Bold as Love, but they weren't really happy with the quality of the studios. Fun fact, by the way, on the song If Six Were Nine, there's a pair of famous feet that are doing some of the foot stomping on that song. Graham Nash from Crosby, Stills and Nash and a bunch of other groups. Anyway, when the Experience got back from America in July of that year, they went back into the studio to finish Axis Bold as Love. And somewhere during that time, Jimmy managed to forget one of the master tapes in the back of a taxi in London. The producers had to rework at least 5 songs, but they didn't quite hit the same quality as they had with the original master's tapes. And towards the end of the album, tensions were beginning to show as Jimmy's perfectionist ways started to grate on everyone's last nerve, especially Chas Chandler's, as Jimmy wanted to do multiple takes on songs. As Mitch Mitchell said, quote, "Axis was the first time that it became apparent that Jimmy was pretty good working behind the mixing board as well as playing and had some positive ideas on how he wanted things recorded. It could have been the start of any potential conflict between him and Chas in the studio," end quote. Axis Bold as Love was released on December 1st, 1967 in England, but not until 1968 in America in order to capitalize on Hendrix's Monterey performance. When the album finally did get released, it became a huge hit, going to number 3 in America and selling 1 million copies. In the United Kingdom, the album hit number 5 and sold 100,000 copies. The album has the songs Castles in the Sand and Little Wing, plus many more, and is known for being Jimmy's take on psychedelia rock. It is a pure classic. And to prove it, we put the album onto this week's podcast playlist, the link to which is now, of course, in the show notes. The Jimi Hendrix Experience's Axis Bold as Love, inducted into the Grammy Museum Hall of Fame in Los Angeles, California, in 2006.
The Music Halls of Fame podcast is part of the Music History Today Network, which can be found under Music History Today on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And also on our YouTube page under Music History Today. Thank you very much for listening.